Okay, Hebrews chapter 11 is where we're at, and Hebrews chapter 11, this is known as the Hall of Faith chapter, but when you read down through the examples of this Hall of Faith chapter, or examples of faith, or faithful people, that you will see that the writer adds, includes the work to their faith. By faith, Abel offered. By faith, Enoch was translated. Now, that one's obviously not his work. By faith, Noah, being warned of God, moved with fear. By faith, Abraham, when it was called, obeyed, and so forth. Okay, so remember that this letter to the Hebrews, doctrinally, is written to the Hebrews, not Jewish Christians, but Hebrews, who will be living during a time period called the last days. And of course, that's when their faith is going to be absolutely challenged and put on trial. 1 Peter 1, verse 7, that the trial of your faith, being much more precious than of gold that perisheth, though it be tried with fire. Okay, and so this idea of faith being tried, the writer is giving several examples of people whose faith was tried. Okay, like the faith of Abel, he suffered as a martyr. Noah, well, for over 100 years while he's building the boat, he suffered so much ridicule and persecution during that time period. Abraham's faith, well, he was promised something that took over 20 years to get the promise. Joseph, his faith, I mean, where he was thrown in jail for a while. Moses, he was in the backside of the desert for waiting 40 years for God to do something. So these people that are given examples, their faith was tried. Okay, so Hebrews chapter 11. Verse 1, this is the ingredients to faith. Okay, Hebrews 11, verse 1. Now, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Okay, substance is what scientists use. Chemicals, substance, experiments. Evidence is what attorneys will use in a courtroom setting. Now, faith is a substance and evidence. Now, the world, especially the intellectual crowd, will mockingly say to Bible believers or Christians that we have a blind faith, and that faith or religion is something that must be taken by faith because it can't be proven. You cannot prove the existence of God, they say. And so some of them mockingly say that faith is what the Christian needs to hold to in order to deal with life. Well, what does the secular student or college professor holds to deal with life? His bottle, his drugs, his music, his career. Okay, so they have to hold to something. Faith in the Word of God just is something that you're holding onto. Now, faith in the Word of God has substance and evidence. Faith in the evolutionary theory has nothing. There's nothing to it. Scientists are so precise, give or take 3 or 4 billion. They have an extreme faith. Evolutionists don't like the idea that their theory of the evolutionary theory is the same as a religion. It's faith that can't be proven. Now, evolutionists and creationists, neither one witnessed the origin of the earth. Okay, but you see, we have evidence. We have evidence that the earth was created by the evidence of the earth and the substance of the earth. Okay, where are the missing links that the thousands and millions of missing links, meaning the transitional fossils from an amoeba to a bird or from a fish to a mammal? Where are the transitional fossils? You know, platypus of Australia is almost like a transitional fossil or a transitional animal, but the platypus stays a platypus. It's like God's joke on the evolutionist. A whale is God's joke on an evolutionist, where a whale, according to the evolutionary theory, evidently learned to walk on ground, land, and then learn how to breathe, but then he backslid and went back into the water. How many whales drowned before they learned how to breathe? So these are jokes that God plays on man to make his education foolishness, where he takes the wise in their foolishness. A few years back, a couple, two, 3 years ago, there were some dolphins and whales that were beaching themselves on the eastern coast. You know, and the environmentalists and the animal rights activists quickly went out there and is going to save the whales, push them back into the ocean, where these whales committed whalecide or dolphicide, you know, killing themselves. You know, and I wrote comments in the newspapers or in the online, where you have the online news media where you can put comments, and my comment was, leave them alone. They're trying to evolve and to become a college professor someday. But, you know, folks like that that have no evidence of their faith, they're not too relaxed in their beliefs, and they usually get all bent out of shape. But true Bible faith has substance and has evidence. Okay, where the Bible makes a statement, okay, but then there's going to be some substance or evidence that will reinforce the statement. Okay, for example, if a person is walking in a mountain and they, as they're walking, they see a watch, you know, maybe in the thickets, maybe by a tree. Okay, so what is the evidence? The evidence is they have a watch. They see the watch, the substance. It's made up of some things. They didn't see the creator of the watch. They didn't see the owner of the watch. But the evidence states and proves and shows that there was somebody who designed the watch. There was somebody who created the watch, made the watch in a factory of some type. And there was somebody who owned the watch. Okay, and maybe they were walking on the same mountain and dropped it, or maybe it fell off an airplane. But the evidence is that someone designed it, created it, and owned it, even though you didn't see any of them. Now, an evolutionist will see the watch, and from his theory is that evolved through millions and millions of years. He didn't see how it originally got there. I didn't see how it originally got there. Okay, my conclusion is that there was a designer and a creator and an owner. The evolutionist conclusion is that it accidentally landed there after a big explosion and through millions of years evolved and ended up there. Now, which idea, which conclusion is more logical? Well, it's quite obvious. So, faith. Okay, faith is the substance of things hoped for. The evidence of things not seen. The watch is the evidence and substance that I did not see the designer, the creator, and the owner of the watch. So this idea of faith in the Bible is provable in many ways. Not always, but in many, many ways. Hebrews 11, verse 2, for by it the elders obtained a good report. Okay, in this context, the Jewish elders. Through faith, we understand that the worlds were framed by the Word of God. So that things which are seen were not made of things which do appear. Okay, the word framed, it's just like a carpenter. Okay, so if you see a house, okay, the evidence and substance of the house, someone framed it. Some construction, somebody designed it, someone constructed it. Okay, it just didn't evolve through eons of time. Millions and millions of years. Now, according to this, the world was framed, put together by God's spoken word. Okay, and so I believe that. Now, as man, we can use elements that are created and change those elements, manipulate those elements, and we can create a house, or a table, or a desk, or a chair. Okay, but we are relying upon God's creation of planting a seed and watering the seed and the tree growing and harvesting the wood, the timber, and milling the timber and cutting it to size and putting and hammering nails or screws to hold it together. Okay, that's frame, that's the evidence. I mean, the house just didn't evolve out of nothing. Okay, so by faith, through faith, we understand that the worlds were framed by the Word of God. So we see the grass, we see the trees. Now the evolutionists say, well, the similarities of these objects, these plants, these animals show that evolved from the same source. The creationists will say the similarities just reveals that they had the same creator. So, I mean, the faith that the Bible gives is more logical and reasonable than any faith in science. This is why in 1 Timothy chapter 6, it says that Paul said to Timothy, O keep that which is committed to thy trust, avoiding profane and vain babblings and oppositions of science, falsely so called, which some professing have erred concerning the faith. They traded for somebody like Charles Darwin, who was not a scientist per se. His only degree in education was a degree in theology. And this is why the evolutionary theory is a religion based upon blind faith. In Hebrews 11, 1 through 6, the faith of the Bible of the creationist is much more logical and reasonable because we have substance and evidence that we're dealing with. Now, the first individual that's going to be demonstrating his faith is Abel. By faith, Abel offered unto God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain, by which he obtained witness that he was righteous, God testifying of his gifts, and by it he being dead yet speaketh. Well, Abel was a first martyr, a religious martyr. Religion is the biggest killer of people. And Cain's religion has been killing Abel's religion or faith ever since that day. Cain was the most religious, or the first religious, where he's the one that got to started getting the sacrifices in Genesis chapter 4. And I mean, he was the ringleader, shall we say, of establishing a religion. Genesis 4:3, and in the process of time it came to pass that Cain brought of the fruit of the ground an offering unto the Lord, and Abel, he also brought of the firstlings of the flock. So Cain, symbolizing a religion that pretends to offer fruit and vegetables, or pretends to get blood out of fruits or vegetables. The common saying is you can't get blood out of a turnip. Now, Cain and Abel had already been given light about the sacrificial lamb because of the death of the lamb in providing clothes for Adam and Eve. So Cain is out there offering the fruit of the ground, holding it up, the cracker up in the air, saying, "My Lord and my God," saying, "Hocus pocus dominocus," it was wet wine, and now it's the blood of Christ. And Abel was out there where he offered the first slings of his flock, a lamb, the best one. And he placed that on an altar, and Abel's over there, you know, tic-tac-toe, three in a row, tic-tac-toe, three in a row, you know, stand up, sit down, you know, take his towel, clean out the chalice, drink every drop of wine, you know, eat the cracker, no, sucks on the cracker, don't eat the cracker, and he's over there doing his thing with his, you know, turnip and lettuce and grapes on the altar, and all of a sudden a great big thunder boom, lightning come down and struck the altar of Abel, and that proved, that was evidence that God accepted Abel's sacrifice and ignored Cain. Cain got mad about it. You know, said something like to Abel, "You think you're wrong, or you think your religion's always right and mine's wrong. Think your church is always right." And the Lord got involved, and the Lord said unto Cain, "Why art thou wroth?" What you mad about, Cain? "And why is thy countenance fallen? If thou doest well, thou shalt thou not be accepted." Cain, if you did a right thing, if you did a good thing, if you did a well thing, then I'll accept it. Meaning, you didn't do right. And he said, "And if thou doest not well, sin lieth at the door, sin offering. Go ask your brother Abel, he'll give you a lamb, and I'll accept it." And Cain in his pride wouldn't do it. And Abel was pretty excited about God accepting his offering. He's out in the watching his lambs and singing a song, whistling a tune, excited because the Lord has fellowship with him. And Cain is mad at him, guilty. He's envious of him, jealous of him. And Cain just said, "Abel, why don't you just shut up? You're making me mad." "Oh, Abel, you know, I got a lamb. Lord, I'll take your lamb, take this lamb. I ain't taking nothing from you. I was born a Baalite, and I'm going to die a Baalite." And Abel just said, "Well, suit yourself, Cain." And Cain said, "Well, you think you're better than I am." And they got in a fist fight. And Cain killed him. And Cain's religion ever since then has been killing Abel's faith. And that's what the Inquisition was all about. That's what the Dark Ages were about. That was Cain's religion of works jealous and envious of Abel's faith and his trusting in the grace of God. So that's Abel. And Abel's been dead now for, you know, almost 6,000 years, and his testimony is still building rewards in heaven. Okay, the next one. By faith, Enoch was translated that he should not see death, and was not found because God had translated him, for before his translation he had this testimony that he pleased God. Okay, now the word translated, found five times in the Bible. Translated, translation, five times. We just read three of them. And that is the Bible word translation for what believers call the rapture. Okay, where Enoch was translated or raptured prior to the judgment of God, just as the born-again believer will be translated or raptured out prior to Daniel's 70th week, because that's Jacob's trouble. Now, this is the word translate. Translate, translated, translation. Found three times in three verses of the Bible, but five occurrences, three of them in Hebrews. So, Enoch is typifies a born-again believer going up in the rapture. Okay? In a translation, this is part of what's called the first resurrection. Now, the word translated or translation, when you're dealing with words, it's going from one language to another language. The first time the word translate is found in the Bible is 2 Samuel 3, verse 10, where it says to translate the kingdom from the house of Saul and to set up the throne of David over Israel. Okay, that was translating the Jewish kingdom from Saul to David. Now, this is the law. There's a law of first mention where it helps establish a definition of a word. Now, this word translate in this context, okay, where it's translating the kingdom from Saul to David, so when the kingdom was translated to David, the translation was better than the original. The original was Saul. The translation of it was David. That kingdom was better. He was a better king. The translation involved man, Saul and David. The translation involved God. God was involved because he was the one that chose David to be the king, and he's the one that translated and moved the people under David. Okay, the work, the translation, is eternal because the kingdom of Jesus Christ is going to be under the kingdom of David. And not only that, the work was flawless. The work by God was flawless. And the translation did not match the original. It was better. Okay, now that's Saul to David. The second occurrence of the word is in Colossians chapter 1, verse 15. And we need to see those fivefold aspects of the word translated in Colossians 1, verse 13. I might have said 15, but it's 13. Where this says, who hath delivered us from the power of darkness and hath translated us into the kingdom of his dear son. Okay, so this is the translation of a lost sinner translated into the kingdom of his son, Jesus Christ, to be a saved child of God, a born-again believer. Okay, now let's see how our definition takes place here. Okay, man is involved. That's the sinner. From the sinner to the saint. God is involved. God is the one that offered the redemption plan, the salvation plan. God is the one that will seal the saved individual and write their name in the Lamb's Book of Life and seal them unto the day of redemption. Okay, the translation is eternal. Because of the new birth, you have eternal security. The translation is flawless. The salvation is pure. And the translation is better than the original. The saved me, my soul, my rebirth of my soul, is better than my flesh. So the word matches there perfectly also. In Hebrews, okay, again, the fivefold definition. Enoch was involved in the translation. God was the one who translated him. It was eternal because Enoch is still in heaven. Okay, it was flawless because he's in heaven. And the translation is better than the original. Enoch was better off in heaven with the Father than he was on this earth. Okay, now let's take that word translated and put it into the Bible itself, where you go from Hebrew, Greek, into English. Okay, so the translation involves man, the King James translators. God was involved. God guided the King James translators. The translation is eternal. Psalms 12. It's purified seven times forever. It is flawless. And the translation is better than the original. Boy, that's something to think about. Now, this Mr. Enoch, is still testifying today. There's some folks that are trying to find these hidden books, and there's the Book of Enoch. You don't need to worry about the Book of Enoch. We can't figure out the 66 books we do have. But God did inspire one line from Enoch. One line. It's a long line. Put it in the Bible. You'll find it in Jude, verse 14 and 15. It says, "And Enoch, also the seventh from Adam." So we see a perfect number, the number of completeness, seventh. The tenth from Adam was Noah. The 13th from Adam was Nimrod, the devil's number. "So Enoch also, the seventh from Adam, prophesied of these, saying, Behold, the Lord cometh with 10,000 of his saints." So about 4,500 years ago, a little over 4,500 years ago, Enoch told the people prior to the flood that the Lord's coming back. The Lord cometh with 10,000 of his saints. And he probably heard people say, yeah, they've been saying that for years. Now, Enoch has a favorite word, and we're going to see this word prior to the flood. And it says, "To execute judgment upon all, and to convince all that are ungodly, among them of all their ungodly deeds, which they have ungodly committed, and of all their hard speeches, which ungodly sinners have spoken against him." So he sort of had a habit of the word ungodly. If somebody asked Enoch his opinion about something, he said, it's probably ungodly. Probably wicked and ungodly. And you see, prior as it was in the days of Noah, so shall I be in the days of the coming of the Son of Man. If you want to stay true to the Lord in this age, you're going to see that there are many ungodly things. And you're going to feel like you're against everything. Maybe you'll be like in Revelation 2, verse 13, where there was a man called Antipas, and he was a faithful martyr of God. Revelation 2, verse 13. And what a name that is, Antipas. Okay, Revelation 2:13. He says, I know thy works and where thou dwellest, even where Satan's seat is, and thou holdest fast my name and hast not denied my faith, even in those days wherein Antipas was my faithful martyr, who was slain among you where Satan dwelleth. The name Antipas. Antipas. The PAS means everything. It's like Pan-American, all-American. And anti means against everything. During times of apostasy, faithful people will be against virtually all of the beliefs and deeds of society. In the American culture, if the news media is pushing something, if you stood against the exact opposite of what the news media or the news industry is pushing, you will probably be right 95% of the time. Just by standing opposite to them. Because that's in the day and age we're living. Enoch was translated that he should not see death and was not found. So evidently they look for him. Looking everywhere for him. And so some folks might be looking for a believer after the rapture. Because God had translated him. So God did the work. For before his translation, he had this testimony that he pleased God. Well, how did he please God? Next verse. But without faith, it is impossible to please him. So Enoch had faith and remained faithful during times of apostasy. We live in an apostate age. If you go to the average Christian college and ask them to show you an inspired copy of the scriptures, if they're honest, they would say, I don't think I can do that. You say, what Christian college? Oh, 98% of them, 99% of them. That's a fact. Conservative ones, liberal ones, evangelical, fundamentalist. Please show me an inspired copy of the scriptures. Why? Because in their statements of faith, they'll usually say that the inspired copy of the scriptures as originally given to God, which they've never seen. So without faith, it's impossible to please him. So faith is substance and evidence. And then it says, for he that cometh to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. So we need to be diligent in our effort to seek after God. 2 Peter chapter 1, he says in verse 5, and beside all this, giving all diligence, add to your faith virtue, and to virtue knowledge, and so forth. Proverbs 4:23, keep thy heart with all diligence, for out of it are the issues of life. So in verse 6, he says, for he that cometh to God must believe that he is. Now, that belief or faith is rooted in substance and evidence. Where he says in 1 Thessalonians 5, prove all things and hold fast that which is good. You see, this 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 13 reveals why many evangelicals, fundamentalists, can even read and preach from a King James Bible, but it doesn't work in their life. Why? It's because they don't believe in it. 1 Thessalonians 2, verse 13, it says, "For this cause also thank we God without ceasing, because when you received the word of God, which ye heard of us, ye received it not as the word of men, but as it is in truth the word of God, which effectually worketh also in you that believe." In the colleges, they'll tell you that no translations are inspired. They will tell you that translations are works of men. So in the colleges, when they're reading from the New International Version, they're reading from a translation, which, from their own testimony, is not inspired. Hence, it's not the Word of God. Hence, it will not work in them. And the same holds true with the King James, where they'll say the King James is the best translation. But translations are works of men. They don't believe it's the Word of God. Why? Because it's a work of men, according to their viewpoint. This is why the Word of God doesn't work in their life. You must believe in your heart. You must believe in your heart. God is involved in a translation. Man is involved in a translation. The translation is eternal. The translation is flawless. And the translation is better than the original. That's if the individual believes the statement that the Bible is the final authority for all matters of faith and practice. The Bible, one book, is present tense. There's one book that's present tense. I could get in my hands, I could put on a table, I can own and carry and hold, bring forth the word of life. And that book is the final authority for all matters of faith and practice. Hebrews 11:7, "By faith Noah, being warned of God of things not seen as yet," rain falling, water falling from the sky, "moved with fear, preparing an ark to the saving of his house, by the which he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness which is by faith." Okay, I think I stopped at verse 6, and so we'll pick up verse 7 next time.